Leonard of Querm had never committed a crime. He regarded his fellow men with benign interest. He was an artist, and he was also the cleverest man alive, if you used the word clever in a specialised and technical sense. But Lord Vetinardi felt that the world was not yet ready for a man who designed unthinkable weapons of war as a happy hobby. The man was, in his heart and soul, and in everything he did, an artist. Currently, Leonard was painting a picture of a lady from a series of sketches he had pinned up by his easel.
"Ah, my lord," he said, glancing up, "and what is the problem?"
"Is there a problem?" said Lord Vetinari.
"There generally is, my lord, when you come to see me."
"Very well," said Lord Vetinari. "I wish to get several people to the centre of the world as soon as possible."
"Ah, yes," said Leonard. "There is much treacherous terrain between here and there. Do you think I have the smile right? I've never been very good at smiles."
"I said, do you wish them to arrive alive?"
"What? Oh, yes, of course. And fast."
Leonard painted on in silence. Lord Vetinari knew better than to interrupt.
"And do you wish them to return?" said the artist after a while. "You know, perhaps I should show the teeth. I believe I understand teeth."
"Returning them would be a pleasant bonus, yes. This is a vital journey. If it is not successful, the world will end."
"Ah, quite vital, then."
Leonard laid down his brush and stood back, looking critically at his picture.
"I shall require the use of several sailing ships and a large barge," he said after a while, "and I will make a list of other materials for you."
"A sea voyage?"
"To begin with, my lord."
"Are you sure you don't want further time to think?" said Lord Vetinari.
To sort out the fine detail, yes, but I believe I already have the essential idea."
Vetinari looked up at the ceiling of the workroom and the armada of paper shapes and bat-winged devices and other aerial extravaganzas that hung there turning gently in the breeze. "This doesn't involve some kind of flying machine, does it?" he said suspiciously.
Why do you ask?"
"Because the destination is a very high place, Leonard, and your flying machines have an inevitable downwards component."
Yes, my lord, but I believe that sufficient down eventually becomes up, my lord."
"Ah, is this philosophy?"
"Practical philosophy, my lord."
"Nevertheless, I find myself amazed, Leonard, that you appear to have come up with a solution just as soon as I presented the problem." Leonard of Querm cleaned his brush.
"I always say, my lord, that a problem correctly posed contains its own solution. But it is true to say that I have given some thought to issues of this nature. I do, as you know, experiment with devices, which, of course, obedient to your views on this matter, I subsequently dismantle because there are indeed evil men in the world who might stumble upon them and pervert their use. You were kind enough to give me a room with unlimited views of the sky, and I notice things. Oh, I shall require several dozen swamp dragons, too. No, that should be more than 100, I think."
"Ah, you intend to build a ship that can be drawn into the sky by dragons?" said Lord Vetinari, mildly relieved. "I recall an old story about a ship that was pulled by swans and flew all the way to—"
"Swans, I fear, would not work. But your surmise is broadly correct, my lord. Well done. 200 dragons, I suggest, to be on the safe side."
"That, at least, is not a difficulty. They are becoming rather a pest."
"And the help of, 60 apprentices and journeymen from the Guild of Cunning Artificers? Perhaps there should be 100. They will need to work around the clock."
"Apprentices? But I can see to it that the finest craftsmen—" Leonard held up a hand.
"Not craftsmen, my lord," he said. "I have no use for people who have learned the limits of the possible."
The horde found Cohen sitting on an ancient burial mound a little way from the camp. There were a lot of them in this area. The members of the horde had seen them before, sometimes, on their various travels across the world. Here and there, an ancient stone would poke through the snow, carved in a language none of them recognised. They were very old. None of the horde had ever considered cutting into a mound to see what treasures might lie within. Partly, this was because they had a word for people who used shovels, and that word was slave. But mainly, it was because, despite their calling, they had a keen moral code, even if it wasn't the sort adopted by nearly everyone else, and this code led them to have a word for anyone who disturbed a burial mound. That word was die. The horde, each member a veteran of 1,000 hopeless charges, nevertheless advanced cautiously towards Cohen, who was sitting cross-legged in the snow. His sword was thrust deep into a drift. He had a distant, worrying expression.
"Coming to have some dinner, old friend," said Caleb. "It's walrus," said Boy Willie, "again."
Cohen grunted.
"I haven't finished," he said indistinctly.
"Finished what, old friend?"
"Remembering," said Cohen.
"Remembering who?"
"The hero who have buried here, all right."
"Who was he?"
"Dunno."
"What were his people?"
"Fetch me," said Cohen.
"Did he do any mighty deeds?"
"Couldn't fay."
"Then why?"
"Found one's got to remember the poor bugger."
"He don't know anything about him."
"I can still remember him."
The rest of the horde exchanged glances. This was going to be a difficult adventure. It was a good job it was going to be the last.
"You ought to come and have a word with that bard we captured," said Caleb. "He's getting on my nerves. He don't seem to understand what he's about."
"He've just got to write a fager afterwards," said Cohen flatly and damply.
A thought appeared to strike him. He started to pat various parts of his clothing, which, given the amount of clothing, didn't take long.
"Yeah, well, this isn't your basic heroic saga kind of bard, you see," said Caleb, as his leader continued the search. "I told you he wasn't the right sort when we grabbed him. He's more the kind of bard you want if you need some ditty being sung to a girl. We're talking flowers and spring here, boss."
"Ah, got 'em,"
said Cohen. From a bag on his belt he produced a set of dentures, carved from the diamond teeth of trolls. He inserted them into his mouth and gnashed them a few times.
"That's better. What were you saying?"
"He's not a proper bard, boss."
Cohen shrugged.
"He'll just have to learn fast, then. He's got to be better than the ones back in the Empire. They don't have a clue about poems longer than 17 syllables. At least this one's from Ankh-Morpork. He must have heard about sagas."
"I said we should have stopped off at Whale Bay," said Truckle. "Icy wastes, freezing nights, good saga country."
"Yeah, if you like blabber."
Cohen drew his sword from the snowdrift.
"I reckon I'd better go and take the lad's mind off of flowers, then."
"It appears that things revolve around a disk," said Leonard. "This is certainly the case with the sun and the moon, and also, if you recall, the Maria Pesto."
"Well, the ship, they said, went right under the disk," said Arch-Chancellor Ridcully.
"Quite. Known to be blown over the rim near the Bay of Manta during the dreadful storm, and seen by fishermen rising above the rim near Tin Ling some days later, where it crashed down upon a reef. There was only one survivor whose dying words were rather strange."
"I remember," said Ridcully. "He said, 'My God, it's full of elephants.'"
"It is my view that with sufficient thrust and a lateral component, a craft sent off the edge of the world would be swung underneath by the massive attraction and rise on the far side," said Leonard. "Probably to a sufficient height to allow it to glide down to anywhere on the surface."
The wizards stared at the blackboard. Then, as one wizard, they turned to Ponder Stibbons, who was scribbling in his notebook.
"What was that about, Ponder?"
Ponder stared at his notes. Then he stared at Leonard. Then he stared at Ridcully.
Yes, possibly. If you fall over the edge fast enough, the world pulls you back and you go on falling, but it's all round the world.
You're saying that by falling off the world, we... And by we, I hasten to point out, I don't actually include myself, can end up in the sky, said the Dean.
Yes, after all, the sun does the same thing every day.
The Dean looked enraptured.
Amazing, he said. Then you could get an army into the heart of enemy territory. No fortress would be safe. You could rain fire down onto...
He caught the look in Leonard's eye.
On to bad people, he finished lamely.
That would not happen, said Leonard severely, ever.
Could the thing you are planning land on Corri Celesti? Said Lord Vetinari.
Oh, certainly there should be suitable snowfields up there, said Leonard. If there are not, I feel sure I can devise some appropriate landing method. Happily, as you have pointed out, things in the air have a tendency to come down.
Ridcully was about to make an appropriate comment, but stopped himself. He knew Leonard's reputation. This was a man who could invent 7 new things before breakfast, including 2 new ways with toast. This man had invented the ball bearing, such an obvious device that no one had thought of it. That was the very centre of his genius. He invented things that anyone could have thought of. And men who can invent things that anyone could have thought of are very rare men. This man was so absent-mindedly clever that he could paint pictures that didn't just follow you round the room, but went home with you and did the washing up. Some people are confident because they are fools. Leonard had the look of someone who was confident because so far he'd never found a reason not to be. He would step off a high building in the happy state of mind of someone who intended to deal with the problem of the ground when it presented itself. And might.
What do you need from us? Said Ridcully.
Well, the thing cannot operate by magic. Magic will be unreliable near the hub, I understand. But can you supply me with wind?
You have certainly chosen the right people, said Lord Vetinari. And it seemed to the wizards that there was just too long a pause before he went on. They are highly skilled in weather manipulation.
A severe gale would be helpful at the launch, Leonard continued.
I think I can say without fear of contradiction that our wizards can supply wind in practically unlimited amounts, said the patrician. Is that not so, Arch-Chancellor?
I am forced to agree, my lord.
Then if we can rely on a stiff following breeze, I'm sure...
Just a moment, said the Dean,
who rather felt the wind comment had been directed at him.
What do we know of this man? He makes devices and paints pictures, does he? Well, I'm sure this is all very nice, but we all know about artists, don't we? Flibbertigibbets to a man. And what about bloody stupid Johnson? Remember some of the things he built?
Many of the things built by the architect and freelance designer Bergholt Stutley, bloody stupid, Johnson, were recorded in Ankh-Morpork, often on the line where it says, cause of death. He was, people agreed, a genius, at least, if you defined the word broadly. Certainly, no one else in the world could make an explosive mixture out of common sand and water. A good designer, he always said, should be capable of anything. And indeed he was.
I'm sure Mr. Darquorum draws lovely pictures, the Dean went on, but I, for one, would need a little more evidence of his amazing genius before we entrust the world to his, device. Show me one thing he can do that anyone couldn't do if they had the time.
I have never considered myself a genius, said Leonard, looking down bashfully and doodling on the paper in front of him.
Well, if I was a genius, I think I'd know it,
the Dean began and stopped. Absent-mindedly, while barely paying attention to what he was doing, Leonard had drawn a perfect circle. Lord Vetinari found it best to set up a committee system. More of the ambassadors from other countries had arrived at the university, and more heads of the guilds were pouring in, and every single one of them wanted to be involved in a decision-making process without necessarily going through the intelligence-using process first. About 7 committees, he considered, should be about right. and when, 10 minutes later, the first subcommittee had miraculously budded off, he took aside a few chosen people into a small room, set up the miscellaneous committee, and locked the door. "The flying ship will need a crew, I'm told," he said. "It can carry 3 people. Leonard will have to go because, to be frank, he will be working on it even as it departs. And the other 2?
"There should be an assassin," said Lord Downey of the Assassin's Guild.
"No. If Cohen and his friends were easy to assassinate, they would have been dead long ago," said Lord Vetinari.
"Perhaps a woman's touch," said Mrs. Palm, head of the Guild of Seamstresses. "I know they're elderly gentlemen, but my members are—"
"I think the problem here, Mrs. Palm, is that although the Horde are apparently very appreciative of the company of women, they don't listen to anything they say."
"Yes, Captain Carrot."
Captain Carrot Iron Founderson of the City Watch was standing to attention, radiating keenness and a hint of soap.
"I volunteer to go, sir," he said.
"Yes, I thought you probably would."
"Is this a matter for the Watch?" said the lawyer, Mr. Slant. "Mr. Cohen is simply returning property to its original owner."
"That is an insight which had not hitherto occurred to me," said Lord Vetinari smoothly. "However, the City Watch would not be the men I think they are if they couldn't think of a reason to arrest anyone. Commander Vimes?"
"A conspiracy to make an affray should do it," said the head of the watch, lighting a cigar.
"And Captain Carrot is a persuasive young man," said Lord Vetinari.
"Oh, with a big sword," grumbled Mr. Slant.
"Persuasion comes in many forms," said Lord Vetinari. "No, I agree with Arch-Chancellor Ridcully. Sending Captain Carrot would be an excellent idea."
"What? Did I say something?"
said Ridcully.
"Do you think that sending Captain Carrot would be an excellent idea?"
"What? Oh, yes, good lad, keen, got a sword."
"Then I agree with you," said Lord Vetinari, who knew how to work a committee. "We must make haste, gentlemen. The flotilla needs to leave tomorrow. We need a 3rd member of the crew." There was a knock at the door. Vetinari signalled to a college porter to open it. The wizard, known as Rincewind, lurched into the room, white-faced, and stopped in front of the table.
"I do not wish to volunteer for this mission," he said.
"I beg your pardon," said Lord Vetinari.
"I do not wish to volunteer, sir."
"No one was asking you." Rincewind wagged a weary finger.
"Oh, but they will, sir, I will. Someone will say, hey, that Rincewind fellow, he's the adventurous sort. He knows the Horde. Cohen seems to like him. He knows all there is to know about cruel and unusual geography. He'd be just the job for something like this."
He sighed.
"And then I'll run away and probably hide in a crate somewhere that'll be loaded onto the flying machine in any case."
"Will you?"
"Probably, sir. Or there'll be a whole string of accidents that'll end up causing the same thing. Trust me, sir. I know how my life works. So I thought I'd better cut through the whole tedious business and come along and tell you I don't wish to volunteer."
"I think you've left out a logical step somewhere," said the patrician.
"No, sir. It's very simple. I'm volunteering. I just don't wish to. But after all, when did that have anything to do with anything?"
"He's got a point, you know," said Ridcully. "He seems to come back from all sorts of—"
"You see,"
Rincewind gave Lord Vetinari a jaded smile.
"I've been living my life for a long time. I know how it works."
There were always robbers near the hub. There were pickings to be had amongst the lost valleys and forbidden temples, and also amongst the less prepared adventurers. Too many people, when listing all the perils to be found in the search for lost treasure or ancient wisdom, had forgotten to put, at the top of the list, the man who arrived just before you. One such party was patrolling its favourite area when it espied first a well-equipped warhorse tethered to a frost-shrivelled tree. Then it saw a fire burning in a small hollow out of the wind, with a small pot bubbling beside it. Finally, it saw the woman. She was attractive, or at least had been conventionally so perhaps 30 years ago. Now she looked like the teacher you wished you'd had in your first year at school, the one with the understanding approach to life's little accidents, such as a shoe full of wee. She had a blanket around her to keep out the cold. She was knitting. Stuck in the snow beside her was the largest sword the robbers had ever seen. Intelligent robbers would have started to count up the incongruities here. These, however, were the other kind, the kind for whom evolution was invented. The woman glanced up, nodded at them, and went on with her knitting.
"Well, now, what have we here?" said the leader. "Are you—"
"Hold this, will you?" said the old woman, standing up. "Over your thumbs, young men. It won't take a moment for me to wind a fresh ball. I was hoping someone would drop by."
She held out a skein of wool. The robber took it uncertainly, aware of the grins on the faces of his men, but he opened his arms with what he hoped was a suitably evil, little does she suspect, look on his face.
"That's right," said the old woman, standing back.
She kicked him viciously in the groin, in an incredibly efficient, if unladylike way, reached down as he toppled, caught up the cauldron, flung it accurately at the face of the first henchman, and picked up her knitting before he fell. The two surviving robbers hadn't had time to move, but then one unfroze and leapt for the sword. He staggered back under its weight, but the blade was long and reassuring.
"Ha-ha-ha!" he said, and grunted as he raised the sword. "How the hell did you carry this, old woman?"
"It's not my sword," she said. "It belonged to the man over there."
The man risked a look sideways. A pair of feet in armoured sandals were just visible behind a rock. They were very big feet. "But I've got a weapon," he thought. And then he thought. So did he. The old woman sighed and drew two knitting needles from the ball of wool. The light glinted on them, and the blanket slid away from her shoulders and fell onto the snow.
"Well, gentlemen," she said.
Cohen pulled the gag off the minstrel's mouth. The man stared at him in terror.
"What's your name, son?" said Cohen. "You kidnapped me. I was walking along the street and—"
"How much?" said Cohen.
"What?"
"How much to write me a saga?"
"You stink."
"Yeah, it's the walrus," said Cohen evenly. "Spit like garlic in that respect. Anyway, a saga, that's what I want. And what you want is a big bag of rubies, not unadjacent in size to the rubies what I have here."
He upended a leather bag into the palm of his hand. The stones were so big the snow glowed red. The musicians stared at them.
"You got—" "What's that word, Truckle?" said Cohen.
"Art,"
said Truckle. "You got art, and we got rubies. We give you rubies, you give us art," said Cohen. "End of problem, right?"
"Problem?"
The rubies were hypnotic.
"Well, mainly the problem you'll have if you tell me you can't write me a saga," said Cohen,
still in a pleasant tone of voice.
"But look, I'm sorry, but sagas are just primitive poems, aren't they?"
The wind, never ceasing here near the hub, had several seconds in which to produce its more forlorn yet threatening whistle.
"It'll be a long walk to civilization, all by yourself," said Truckle at length.
"Without your feet," said Boy Willie.
"Please? Nah, lads, we don't want to do that to the boy," said Cohen.
"He's a bright lad, got a great future ahead of him."
He took a pull of his home-rolled cigarette and added,
"Up until now. Nah, I can see he's thinking about it. A heroic saga, lad. It'll be the most famousest one ever."
"What about?"
"Us."
"You? But you're all old—"
The minstrel stopped. Even after a life that had hitherto held no danger greater than a hurled meat bone at a banquet, he could recognise sudden death when he saw it. And he saw it now. Age hadn't weakened here, well, except in one or two places. Mostly it had hardened.
"But I wouldn't know how to compose a saga," he said feebly.
"We'll help," said Truckle. "We know lots," said Boy Willie.
"Been in most of them," said Cohen.
The minstrel's thoughts ran like this. These men are rubies insane. They are rubies sure to kill me, rubies. They've dragged me rubies, all the rubies, rubies.
They want to give me a big bag of rubies.
I suppose I could extend my repertoire, he mumbled.
A look at their faces made him readjust his vocabulary.
All right, I'll do it, he said.
A tiny bit of honesty, though, survived even the glow of the jewels.
I'm not the world's greatest minstrel, you know.
You will be, after you write this saga, said Cohen, untying his ropes.
Well, I hope you like it.
Cohen grinned again.
It's not up to us to like it. We won't hear it, he said.
What? But you just said you wanted me to write you a saga.
Yeah, but it's going to be the saga of how we died.
It was a small flotilla that set sail from Ankh-Morpork the next day. Things had happened quickly. It wasn't that the prospect of the end of the world was concentrating minds unduly, because that is a general and universal danger that people find hard to imagine. But the patrician was being rather sharp with people, and that is a specific and highly personal danger, and people had no problem relating to it at all. The barge, under whose huge tarpaulin something was already taking shape, wallowed between the boats. Lord Vetinari went aboard only once and looked gloomily at the vast piles of material that littered the deck. "This is costing us a considerable amount of money," he told Leonard, who had set up an easel. "I just hope there will be something to show for it."
"The continuation of the species, perhaps," said Leonard, completing a complex drawing and handing it to an apprentice.
"Obviously that, yes."
"We shall learn many new things," said Leonard, "that I am sure will be of immense benefit to posterity. For example, the survivor of the Maria Pesto reported that things floated around in the air as if they had become extremely light. So I have devised this."
He reached down and picked up what looked to Lord Vetinari like a perfectly normal kitchen utensil.
"It's a frying pan that sticks to anything," he said proudly. "I got the idea from observing a type of teasel, which—"
"And will this be useful?" said Lord Vetinari.
"Oh, indeed. We will need to eat meals and cannot have hot fat floating around. These small details matter, my lord. I have also devised a pen which writes upside down."
"No. Could you not simply turn the paper up the other way?"
An extract from the Journal of Leonard of Querm. "It appears to me that the substance that surrounds our world is as navigable as the sea or the air, having instead of winds and currents the shaping of the ether by the presence of matter in greater or lesser amounts. The sun and moon and the minor planets, which I believe are made of elephant dung, daily circumnavigate the turtle by a process which I may describe as a fall which never ends, or ring path. All is a matter of thrust and direction and curves that may be described with absolute accuracy. In the world, perfection, in the heavens, the sublime geometry." The line of sledges moved across the snow.
"It's damn cold," said Caleb. "Feeling your age, are you?" said Boy Willie. "You're as old as you feel, I always say."
"What?"
"He says you're as old as you feel, Hamish."
"What? Feeling what?"
"I don't think I've become old," said Boy Willie. "Not your actual old. Just more aware of where the next lavatory is."
"The worst bit," said Truckle, "is when young people come and sing happy songs at you."
"Why are they so happy?" said Caleb.
"'Cause they're not you, I suppose."
Fine, sharp snow crystals, blown off the mountain tops, hissed across their vision. In deference to their profession, the horde mostly wore tiny leather loincloths and bits and pieces of fur and chainmail. In deference to their advancing years, and entirely without comment among themselves, these had been underpinned now with long woolly combinations and various strange elasticated things. They were dealing with time as they had dealt with nearly everything else in their lives, as something you charged at and tried to kill. At the front of the party, Cohen was giving the minstrel some tips.
"First off, you've got to describe how you feel about the saga," he said. "How singing it makes your blood race, and you can hardly contain yourself, that—" You've got to tell him what a great saga it's going to be, understand?
Yes, I think so. And then I say who you are,
said the minstrel, scribbling furiously.
Nah! Then you say what the weather was like.
Oh, you mean like it was a bright day?
Man, you've got to talk saga. So first off, you've got to put the sentences the wrong way round.
Oh, you mean like bright was the day?
Right, good. I knew you was clever.
Clever you was, you mean, said the minstrel, before he could stop himself. There was a moment of heart-stopping uncertainty, and then Cohen grinned and slapped him on the back. It was like being hit with a shovel.
That's the style. What else now? Oh, yeah. No one ever talks in sagas. They always spakes.
Spakes?
Like, up spake Wolf the Sea Rover, see? And people are always the something, like me. I'm Cohen the Barbarian, right? But it could be Cohen the Bold-Hearted, or Cohen the Slayer of Many, or any of that class of thing.
Why are you doing this? Said the minstrel. I ought to put that in. You're going to return fire to gods?
Yeah, with interest.
But why?
"'Cause we've seen a lot of old friends die, said Caleb. That's right, said Boy Willie. And we never saw no big women on flying horses come and take them into the halls of heroes. When old Vincent died, him being one of us, said Boy Willie, where was the bridge of frost to take him to the feast of the gods, eh? No, they got him. They let him get soft with comfy beds and someone to chew his food for him. They nearly got us all.
Ha! Milky drinks, spat Truckle.
What? Said Hamish, waking up.
He asked why we want to return fire to the gods, Hamish.
Eh? Someone's got to do it,
cackled Hamish.
Because it's a big world and we ain't seen it all, said Boy Willie.
Because the boogers are immortal, said Caleb.
Because of the way my back aches on chilly nights, said Truckle.
The minstrel looked at Cohen, who was staring at the ground.
Because, said Cohen, because they've let us grow old.
At which point the ambush was sprung. Snowdrifts erupted. Huge figures raced towards the horde. Swords were in skinny, spotted hands with a speed born of experience. Clubs were swung.
Hold everything, shouted Cohen.
It was a voice of command. The fighters froze. Blades trembled an inch away from throat and torso. Cohen looked up into the cracked and craggy features of an enormous troll, its club raised to smash him.
Don't I know you?
He said.